Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to a special co-produced edition of the Mormon Matters, Engaging Gospel Doctrine, and Feminist Mormon Housewife Podcasts. Yay, this is our first joint effort that we've done together. I'm Dan Weatherspoon. I'm the host of Mormon Matters, and joining me are also the hosts from the other two. That's Jared Anderson of Engaging Gospel Doctrine and Lindsay Hansen-Park, who's one of the hosts of the Feminist Mormon Housewives Podcast. And we're teaming up to produce an episode that we think will be of broad interest to all of our audiences. And what we're basically going to do is examine the main outlines of scholarly discussions, within faith tradition discussions, etc., of what has been often referred to as the quote-unquote quest for the historical Jesus. And especially as we kind of get into the details of that, we're going to be looking at those places where that might differ from what's sometimes been called the Christ of faith. So the historical Jesus, who he was as he walked and talked and you know, breathed and did his thing in the ancient world, versus the overlays of faith and claims and whatnot that might have been put upon him. And, you know, this is, of course, one of the most contested areas of Christian scholarship. It's difficult because, as these guys that we have on here, we have Jared as well as Eric Huntsman, and we'll have him introduce himself in a minute. As they kind of show us, it's going to be very, very difficult. The sources are fragmentary. They're, you know, it's just hard to go back that many years ago. And it's also complicated because pretty much everybody who gets involved with this quest and talking about these different things also usually has a stake in the question, you know, a certain amount of faith. They kind of want Jesus to be this way or that way, and sources get oriented in different ways. And that, of course, includes the gospel writers, as we'll learn, too. There's different presentations of Jesus right there in the New Testament. So anyway, I have Jared and Lindsay. I'll have them introduce themselves in a bit, but Eric, would you go ahead and tell us a little bit about you? This is Eric Huntsman, and Eric, when Jared and I first started talking about getting this discussion going, he says, we can't do this without Eric Huntsman, so thank you for coming, for being willing, for being available. Tell us why he's so excited about you.
Well, that's kind. I don't know if he'll be so happy after we're done that I'm here, but let me just tell you a little bit about myself. I'm currently an associate professor of ancient scripture at BYU, and I am the coordinator or director of the Ancient Near Eastern Studies program at BYU's Kennedy Center for International Studies. But actually, by training, I did my PhD in ancient history, Greek and Roman history. Roman imperial history is my specialty. And I taught 9 years in classics before I moved over to ancient scripture. So I actually had to do a fair amount of retooling to reinvent myself, if you will, as a student of New Testament studies, even though I already had the language and the historical background. Anyway, so I think that's why Jared wanted to have me on here, is because I had both the historical background and then in the last 10 years, some of the New Testament studies background, I think, to help address this issue of the historical Jesus. I've done a little bit of writing. Some of you know Jesus Christ in the World, the New Testament, that I co-authored with Richard Holtzapfel and Tom Waymont a number of years ago, which was an attempt on our part to bring a lot of biblical scholarship to the LDS mainstream. I've since done a couple books on my own on the passion narratives and the infancy narratives. They came out in 2011, God So Loved the World, The Final Days of the Savior's Life, and Good Tidings of Great Joy and Advent Celebration of the Savior's Birth. Another reason why I'm actually excited about this podcast is we're talking about various criteria of authenticity as we get into the historical Jesus discussion, is I have a book coming out this next year with Deseret Book on the miracles of Jesus. where I actually look at the miracles. And in the body of the work, I have to be gentle with that given the audience, but in the appendix of the book, I have quite a bit on form criticism and source criticism and this whole issue of historicity of miracles. So hopefully I'll have something to bring to the table this discussion.
Man, totally. Well, congratulations on all that. And seriously, with your books that you've brought out so far, that really is, you know, being fair to the sources as well as, you know, knowing that you're writing for an LDS audience, has it been well received? Or
I think so. You know, it's a bit of a challenge, as anyone who's interested in LDS studies is aware. You know, on the one hand, we have a market which wants homiletics. We want to be inspired and uplifted and encouraged. So sometimes we have to kind of temper scholarship or make it more accessible. And there's a number of ways that we can try to do that. But I have always felt very strongly that we need to be ambidextrous, that we need to speak the language of scholarship and the language of faith, not necessarily privilege one over the other. So I try to be very careful, methodical in my biblical exposition. But on the other hand, I'm not shy at all of sharing my own faith and my own belief. So it's an interesting thing to negotiate. You know, some publishers are not as interested in as much scholarship, and so sometimes it's kind of a hard sell, but I think we've been reasonably successful so far.
If I can give another plug for Eric and why I'm so excited to have him on here, and this will embarrass him a little bit, but I think Eric is one of the very best that we have in our tradition of balancing faith and scholarship. And I think that you'd agree, Eric, that we have a lot to learn from our Catholic and evangelical brothers and sisters who have a long tradition, you know, of blending faith and scholarship. This is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but when people ask me about BYU religious studies and teaching, which you know very well all of its challenges, I kind of joke that there are, just because of the hiring practices and the way CES is organized, as from an academic perspective, there are those who don't know what they're doing. There are those who know what they're doing and don't. And there are those who know what they're doing and do. And I put you and Holzapfel and a handful of others in that final group. So it's...
Well, you're kind, Jared. Let me be a little bit of an apologist, which I'm not by nature, as you know, or temperament. We have some fine people down here at BYU in a number of fields, and we've made some wonderful hires in past years. Mm-hmm. But I must also say that I have a great deal of respect for my colleagues who are of the more traditional shape. I just think people need to be who they are and own it. And if someone's avocation is to teach missionary prep and to inspire the saints, then do it and do it well. But if you have the skills and the interest to do scholarship, do that and be honest about it. We could probably mention the name Heidegger later, a great philosopher who talked a lot about this issue of hermeneutical circle, which I'm sure, Jared, you'll want to bring up later. But it's this idea that we never look at scriptural text or scriptural belief without being informed or shaped by what our pre-existing beliefs were. Right. And Heidegger said, you know, when we find out about this hermeneutical circle, people are desperate to get out of it. But Heidegger said, what's more important than how you get out of the hermeneutical circle is to understand and recognize how you got into it. So I'm one who says, let's be methodical, let's be scholarly, let's look at the evidence, let's be rational in our judgments, but let's also be upfront and honest with what our worldview is. So there's room for lots of people in this big tent. I'm the ultimate moderate. Jared has seen me online kind of take hits for that, because neither liberals or conservatives like you if you're a moderate. But my view is that let's just have a big tent and bring as many people into the discussion and have as respectful conversation as possible.
Amen. Awesome. Thank you so much, Eric. Can't wait to hear you in action here in a minute. Jared, while you're here, tell us a little bit about your background again for those who, from especially the other podcasts, mine and Lindsay's, who may not know you a little bit.
Yeah, so Jared Anderson, I am finally finishing my PhD in New Testament. I am writing my dissertation on the Gospels. I'm seeking to reconstruct Matthew's form of Mark. Very excited about that. As you said, I run the Mormon Sunday School podcast. I actually just founded a nonprofit that will house that, the Olam Institute. And I'm also very interested in the future of religion and other projects that I'm excited to work on in the next couple of years. But first, need to finish the dissertation.
Yeah, good. Definitely get, yeah,
get it done, Jared.
That's for sure. I remember those days. Anyway, well, thanks for being here, Jared. And is there anything just in general that you want to frame about this discussion before we begin? We can turn it over to you, you know, obviously to launch us later. But
Yeah, so for the historical Jesus episode, we'll talk more about this, and I've gone into it in my Mormon Stories interview as well. But I think the historical Jesus is either unfamiliar or scary to faithful listeners, because our relationship with Jesus, it's very personal, it's very important. And I want people to understand what the sources look like. And one of the approaches that I've tried to model in my Sunday School podcast is understand the evidence and reality as best we can, and then come to theological conclusions. Because I'm all for, you know, theology and lives of faith, and it's extremely important in our human experience. But I think that we have a much more robust, you know, to use your word, and a rich and resilient faith that does better work in our lives if we are aware of the situation. And I think that we can talk about the historical Jesus in a way that acknowledges the virtues and strength of both faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, and also help listeners understand what people are talking about when they talk about the historical Jesus. And one final thing before we move on is, one of my pet peeves is when people try to use academic methodology to prove faith claims. And that's like punting in a basketball game. It just doesn't work. You know, the methodologies don't work that way. And so I'm very pro-faith, but I think it's, again, once again, responsible when people can say, well, academically, this is how it looks, and I have faith in this. You know, instead of trying to say, well, academia completely debunks faith, or it absolutely proves faith. Because one fun thing to remember is that anything that cannot be disproved cannot be proved. And that's the whole purpose of faith. So there are realms of faith when it comes to Jesus, and there are realms of scholarship, and we'll be talking about both during this time.
Terrific. Lindsay, welcome to the podcast. Of course, it's your podcast too, with our triple production here, but remind everybody a little bit about who you are and your backgrounds, and then a little bit about your hopes and dreams for this fine day of recording.
Well, thank you for having me. First of all, I have two disclaimers. One is, I have little kids running around, so if you hear that in the background, that's kind of a standard for the Feminist Mormon Housewives podcast.
Nice.
So there's that. And the second is, I'm down to my last Diet Coke, so heaven help us all. Let's hope that I can survive the podcast with kids and one Diet Coke left.
Nice.
I host the Feminist Mormon Housewives podcast. I blog for Feminist Mormon Housewives as Winter Buzz, and I work for Sunstone, so it's just kind of what I do.
Yeah. And what's your interest in this topic, and what are the things that you hope will steer in you know, arenas that you're most interested in?
Yeah, well, I always kind of envision Jesus personally as this, you know, Aryan, feminized Greg Olson type of this. And we often talk, when we're talking online, about Jesus as like this idea of being Christ-like, which is kind and generous and kind of a peaceful hippie.
Oh, you've been reading too much Luke. You have to read a little bit more Mark.
Yeah, exactly. I like that. And so there's a lot of, you know, a lot of us kind of projecting our own cultural identity and maybe political agendas onto who Jesus really was. So I'm interested in that, but I'm also interested, as a woman who has very little to deal with as far as female examples in the scriptures that aren't, you know, villainized as prostitutes or virgins, it's really hard for us to envision ourselves in the divine. And so it's really nice that Jesus is sort of feminized in our culture. So I'm interested in the historical accuracy of that. I also am interested in the socio-economical part of Jesus. Him being, you know, poor and speaking Aramaic and speaking the people's language, as opposed to the rich, you know, Greek and Roman elite. So those are the aspects that I think kind of interest me and my audience, if that makes sense.
So great. We will try to get to all those and make sure that we do whenever there's a chance, please. So, all right. Yes.
Can I say something I hope for before we get into
this? Yes. I didn't do that.
Yeah. One stake, one claim. Jared will be guiding us through this, and he already has an agenda set up. But, you know, I have felt both professionally and avocationally that my big aim is to improve scriptural and gospel literacy, which means in our community, in our faith community, which means that if we care about these texts, primarily as religious texts, foundational texts, but also as literary artifacts from the ancient world, as well as historical artifacts, that we should bring every tool that we can to bear on understanding them better. That's historical, that's cultural, that's sociological. It has to do with bringing faith and revelation and inspiration. And so I'm just a real advocate of looking at it from all angles. The other thing I wanted to mention, and this is just a correction from my point of view, and maybe Jared will hone this or repudiate it. I'm a little chary or wary of how we use the term historical Jesus. It is true, and we'll go through the history of historical Jesus studies in a moment. It is true that in the so-called First Quest, they really believe that they were discovering the actual historical man of Nazareth. But that was thrown out with the Second Quest. And I think, Jared, I've heard you talk about this before, Jared. I think you'd agree with me on this. For the most part, history is unrecoverable. And we'll talk about the history of historiography in a moment. When we talk about historical Jesus today, we're not necessarily talking exactly how the man of Nazareth was, what he was like, what he said, what he did. Rather, we're saying what acts and words attributed to Jesus are historically verifiable. And that's something very different from saying this is Jesus. It is the group or the set of acts and words of Jesus that we can bring academic or scholarly criteria to bear on to say, this looks demonstrable. But the historical Jesus from that perspective is not necessarily coterminous with the actual Jesus any more than sometimes the Christ of faith is. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. The way I like to distinguish it is I like to talk about the past versus history, you know, instead of using history both ways, where the past is largely irrecoverable. You know, we can't even accurately remember our own lives, like psychologically. You know, they've done tests that we don't even remember what really happens to us. And so, as you said, yes, when we're talking about the historical Jesus, it isn't Jesus of Nazareth of the past as he really was. It is what Jesus as he can be reconstructed or verified through the methods of history.
And this sounds like a fine point, but for someone like myself who tries to negotiate both worlds, it's really important that if an act or deed of Jesus cannot be historically verifiable by historical criteria, that doesn't mean it's not true, that the Jesus past, to use Jared's term, didn't say or do that. It simply means that from an academic perspective, we cannot demonstrate that X number of criteria that we've resolved upon, you know, show that historically that seems plausible. And I don't want to go off too much on this, but, you know, I used to be an ancient historian before I moved into New Testament studies. And I always remind my students that before the great German universities, we're talking the 18th and 19th centuries, history was always part of literature. It wasn't what we now call a social science, which always seems a bit like an oxymoron to me. But anyway, it was not part of a social science. But in these great German universities, we had these polymaths like Wilhelmowitz and Mommsen in the Greek and the Roman fields. And they thought if they got all the evidence, not just all the literature, but all the coins, all the archaeologies, all the scraps of evidence to get together, they could reconstruct, you know, with 98% certitude what actually happened. And they believed it. And historical Jesus studies grew out of that. But I had a classics professor as an undergraduate who used to always say, history is nothing but rhetoric. History is you trying to convince other people what you think happened, as Jared says, in the past, or what you want people to think happened in the past happened. And historians always have their own biases, and this will come to play as we talk about some of the great figures in historical Jesus studies. They always have their own agenda or portrait in mind, as do we. And so I just want to make sure we're upfront with this, that as we're talking about the historical Jesus, and particularly as if Jared and I say, this doesn't seem historical, that doesn't mean we don't personally believe that the Jesus of the past, once again to use Jared's term, did not say or do that. We're simply saying that in academic context or in a discourse of historical studies, we cannot say that with academic certitude. Does that make any sense, Dan and Lindsay?
Yeah, but I have a question. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So with professional history is a relatively new term, as opposed to historians in the past who were, you know, attaching their own cultural identities to the history or their own cultural moral narratives to the history. Professional history seeks to take a really scientific approach to history. And one thing that they really count on are their sources, right? But for Jesus, we don't have any primary sources, right? The Bible is looked on as a primary source, but it's really a secondhand telling of what Jesus said. We have none of Jesus's writings. We have no recording of Jesus. We have nothing like that. So these are all really secondhand accounts.
Right,
so
but one thing to put in context there, Lindsay, is that's actually not very unusual. Let me give you another famous figure for whom we have no quote-unquote primary sources, Socrates. Socrates left no writings of his own.
And right, but isn't he up for debate? I mean,
that's the point. Any one of these figures of the past is up for debate.
We do have differing degrees of sources for different figures. I mean, in fact, Jesus is highly unusual because he was such a marginal figure. You know, he wasn't. We have writings of Julius Caesar, don't we, Eric?
Yeah, we have his commentary and we have the letters of Cicero. So you're correct. We have figures for whom we do have primary evidence.
Yeah, but that's because they're the elite. You know, yeah, it's normal to have the elite.
Class number one, whereas Socrates was middle class and Jesus seems to have been lower class. But we also don't tend to have it as much for philosophic and religious figures.
I was just going to say, the reason why I bring this up is I feel like the context is important, because in our current society and for many years, many centuries, we have let what we think Jesus said shape our culture, shape our law, shape our society. And so I think it's really important that we keep it in context, that that the evidence is kind of foggy as far as what we actually know Jesus did or did not say. And so I really wish that there was more emphasis on that. I mean, even in our Mormon church, we prioritize Jesus's words in the gospel over everything, right? But working with church historians, I understand how they prioritize sources, say, about Joseph Smith or about his detractors. And it's interesting that we don't give the same sort of weight or criteria or process to Jesus.
Well, Lindsay, we're gonna go into more detail on this, but we simply don't have anything better than the Gospels. And in fact, I would make the point that it would be nice if we paid more attention to the Gospels, because I don't think we even do that. One of the motto of the Sunday School podcast is challenge and be challenged by the Scriptures. And one thing that we'll talk about, kind of the different Jesuses, and you brought up this whole, like, what would Jesus do? You know, the nice Jesus. That actually, and I'm talking rhetorically and functionally here, you know, Jesus, who knows? I know Jesus was an example, and we talk about him as an example, but when we say, what would Jesus do, we are actually making up a Jesus that does the very best things in every situation. You know, like this paragon and this ideal.
Yeah, we don't
not paying any attention to what he actually did and
said. We don't
said.
Have any example of what Jesus did when the dog, you know, ate the groceries. I mean, mm-hmm. We just don't have examples in the surviving text. Even before we do what Lindsay's asking us to, you know, historically analyze and weigh the evidence in those texts, we don't have that many examples of Jesus in certain situations behaving a certain way. This is deduced from the general principles that we accept represent his teachings.
And on the other hand, I think that we can pay closer attention to the things that challenge us. You know, like what do we make of the fact that Jesus says, you know, whoever does not hate his father and mother is not worthy of to be my disciple. Now, Grant, in fact, that's funny because my students, that's also in the Gospel of Thomas, and they would do this test where they needed to analyze the Gospel of Thomas, and they would be like, oh, Jesus would never say anything like hate your father and mother. And I loved just writing in the margins the reference to that, which I think is like Luke 14:26.
Well, yeah, that's what I like. I'm interested in the Mormon Jesus versus the scriptural Jesus, because Eric asked, what would Jesus do when the dog eats the groceries? And I know the Mormon answer to that, which is Jesus would do the perfect thing. Whatever we think the perfect thing is in that situation, that, of course, is what Jesus would do.
Well, yeah. Lindsay, when you bring up the Mormon Jesus, it reminds me of my days in the battlefield trenches. I went to high school in Jackson, Tennessee, so I had locked horns with evangelicals a lot. And my Protestant friends would frequently accuse me of believing in a Mormon Jesus, whereas they believed in the biblical Jesus. And then later I said, well, you believe in an evangelical Jesus. You're looking at the Bible through your lens. I'm looking at it through my lens. It was only when I got into biblical studies, I found out there's not a biblical Jesus. There are at least 7 and maybe 9 biblical Jesuses. There's a Markan Jesus, a Matthean Jesus, a Lucan Jesus, an early Johannine, a late Johannine, an early Pauline, a late Pauline, a one in the Revelation. All these texts presented differently. And I kind of teased you earlier, Lindsay, when I said you've been reading too much Luke. You know, there's this old little ditty, Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible told me so. No, the Gospel of Luke told you so. The Markan Jesus is this John Wayne figure. He's tough. He gets angry with his disciples. I even point out to my students, Jesus is torching cities in Zarahemla, etc., in 3rd Nephi. You know, right. Jesus loves me, this I know, because Zarahemla's toast, you know? I mean, we have this idealized version derived in this instance from one particular gospel's portrait, but then flavored and leavened with our own expectations. And then we, back to Heidegger, we have a hermeneutical circle. And so that's the Jesus we look for in all the other texts.
Yeah, I want to make two comments before we move on. Sorry. Lindsay, you talked about historical limitations, and we'll dig into this. I do want to caution listeners, not that can be an excuse for laziness. And I don't think that that's merited, where we're like, well, if scholars can't know anything about the biblical Jesus, then we can believe whatever we want. You know, we can make Jesus into whatever we would like Jesus to be. But I think that I'm a bit of a historical maximalist. You know, I'm optimistic as a historian. And I think that we can know quite a bit about what Jesus was like, what he was up to, and what he would do in different situations because of what we can reconstruct him and what his motivations were. Like, as a really quick example to tease for a later discussion, the reason why he said, if you do not hate your father and your mother, and he didn't really mean hate your father and mother. He was using a rhetorical device it's almost like a koan, you know, which is like a mind job that just blows your mind. He speaks in these absurd extremes that make you think and make you, you know, reframe your conceptions. But he also says, when his family's looking for him, who is my mother? You know, who are my brothers and sisters? I don't care about them. My disciples. So he talks about this idea that covenantal families and families of deliberate construction, so we might think circles of friends are actual, and ward families are more important than our blood families. And this has important implications. And I think that we can say with quite a bit of confidence that Jesus really did say these things. And then the other thing that you have brought up several times is you are correct. And this goes back to that hermeneutical circle, Eric, is that we do need to beware our own biases and be aware that it is in our nature to invent a Jesus according to our own desires. It's been interesting to see the mythicists like Richard Carrier, and their rhetoric has actually become more intense as this discussion has gone on. Sorry, that was a bit obscure. We can pick this up in more detail, but there is debate about whether Jesus actually existed. And so when I look at, I haven't done a lot of research in this, but when I look at the way they talk about whether Jesus existed, they have intensified from, well, we don't know whether Jesus existed and there are these problems with the sources, to Jesus did not exist, you know, and because in current events, you know, there's more and more arguing about it. And so they're bunkering down and becoming harder. So again, we need to be cautious of our own inclinations so that we can allow the evidence to challenge us and that we can rethink our understanding of Jesus based on a serious reading of the scriptures.
I just want to say one other thing to Dan and Lindsay in particular, and this is me putting on my other hat here. We may not be able to know historically, by historically verifiable methods, that Jesus said X, Y, and Z. But as a believer, I do have confidence that the Jesus whom I come to know through my faith, through revelation, through experience, I can believe that. I'm just very careful to say, I believe Jesus would do X. Or the scriptures say that Jesus said this, and I believe that. Does that make any sense? Mm-hmm. Then we're not using the text as a bludgeon to make other people accept our position, but we're simply speaking from, in this instance, a perspective of faith. you can even use Mormon terminology. We use know, you know, in a broader sense than most people. I know that my Savior loves me, that he cares about people. He would not do this. I'd prefer to say believe in that instance. But I believe that since Jared has talked about how faith is a completely legitimate thing, it's just a different thing than academic knowledge.
Eric, I would make a provocative statement that the Jesus of our personal faith is the most real.
Absolutely.
And the most important.
Earlier to Dan, that the actual Jesus, to me, and I don't want to get all existentialist here, but the actual Jesus is not just the man of Nazareth of the past, it's the glorified living Lord, the risen Lord now to me. But my very faith says that each person needs to come to her or his own understanding of that. And so when I make a proclamation like that, it's only meant to challenge other people to have a Jesus of faith of their own. Does that make any sense?
Awesome.
Yeah, the community of Christ, they have moved away from a literal reading of the text as well. And they say that the scriptures are only as useful as they point people towards God. And that's kind of my interpretation of it as well. Like you're talking about, when I think of the resurrected Jesus, I think of him as resurrected through my understanding.
Oh, well, like Lindsay, here's an example of that. People often ask me, since there's a big thing about whether Santa Claus is white, right, and whether Jesus
no, is actually, that's a big thing. Oh,
like
wow.
A Simon Dooley or Greg Olson painting. And I'll always tell them, the man of Galilee was probably 5'4" and looked like any other Mediterranean peasant. But the risen Lord is pretty awesome. You know, he's Revelation 1 and Doctrine and Covenants 1:10. That's my belief and conception. So I don't know if that dovetailed with that at all. You know, Jared, I think probably the best thing we could do is if we could go through the history of the historical Jesus and lay out how it developed, because we can actually see in the different quests how sometimes it started out with this assurance that historical methods work, to the second quest, no, we'll never know, it's just the fact of Jesus, and then the third quest, and even what some people are doing now in the so-called fourth quest. Does that sound like an approach?
Yeah, let's do that, and then we can dig into like the sources and nitty-gritty. And
right, well, because the criteria we use to analyze those sources were shaped in the process of the development of historical Jesus studies.
Well, Eric, you've taken us right there. Let's just go ahead and have you lay out a little bit about those quests as a beginning point.
This will be kind of simplified, but I think for our purposes it will do. Historical Jesus studies have gone through a number of phases, and today we kind of describe them as the different quests for the historical Jesus. And so what Jared and I would like to do is just kind of go back and forth and talk about the so-called three quests, then talk about the current state of historical Jesus studies. The first quest was roughly 1778 through about 1953, so it was a long endeavor. It began with a man named David Friedrich Strauss, who wrote something called Das Leben Jesu. And what Strauss was doing is he was trying to bring all of the methodologies and skills of what was then current German historiography to bear to the issue of Jesus of Nazareth. And so it took the Bible as any other ancient text. He didn't privilege it. And so it was using a lot of historical criticism and biblical criticism to try to identify what in the biblical accounts of Jesus was considered legitimate. Now, this is, of course, post-Enlightenment. So Strauss didn't believe in miracles, for instance. So he's going to cut those out. But he was one who said, let's look, we have four gospel accounts, let's compare them. If we have multiple attestation, that's one of the important criteria we're going to talk about. If an act or a saying of Jesus is attested in more than one source, then it's more likely to be true. Something else that the first questers were interested in was, how was this Jesus dissimilar from contemporary Judaism and the Christianity that followed closely after him? You know, if there's something unique, that's probably something that's legitimate. So for a good period of time, over 150 years, a number of scholars were just fine-combing all of the evidence, not just the biblical evidence, but extra-biblical evidence, trying to evaluate it and come up with some figure they thought, because of the German approach to history at the time, was the actual Jesus. But this finally gave out when Albert Schweitzer did a monumental survey of all the historical Jesus studies up to that point and made the trenchant observation, there are as many historical Jesuses as there are scholars looking for him. And Schweitzer realized that people always brought to the evidence either their preconceived notion or their agenda or what they were trying to prove. And so the first quest petered out, and we had something called the second quest from 1953, 1963 until the 70s or 80s of the last century, which basically gave up on ever trying to come up with the actual Jesus of the past, as Jared would call it. And the main figure there is someone I used to think was the Antichrist, but now I think is quite intriguing. His name is Rudolf Bultmann, because I always saw him from Johannine studies. He was a big figure in studying the gospel according to John. And, you know, he was always demythologizing the text and saying, Jesus couldn't say this, Jesus couldn't do this. And I had no idea who Bultmann the man was. It was only later that I found out he was a very committed Lutheran. And he believed the most important thing about Jesus was that he existed and that God saved us through Jesus. And that was all we could know from a position of faith, and that's all we needed to know. That everything else was just people's attempts to try to understand him. Jared, do you want to say anything about those first or second quests before we move into the third quest, which I think is the most interesting?
No, keep going.
Well, in the third quest, which began in the 1980s, there were a number of scholars who began to privilege what we would call extra-canonical text. You know, a lot of these texts, Jared mentioned the Gospel of Thomas, but a lot of these other gospels, apocryphal gospels and texts, had been around, but they really came to the forefront of discussion. And so sometimes this third quest, which is still going on, will almost privilege the non-canonical text to the gospels that are in the New Testament. This is what I like to call inversion of authority. People who approach Christ from a position of faith say the gospels are true, and so that's the real Jesus. A lot of people in the early third quest said, the Gospels are suspect. They're written by religious people with their own agendas. So let's believe everything that these other Christianities, these multiplicity of varieties of Christianity believed. But what has happened since that time is that we have the so-called third quest where people are trying to find a new Jesus. So if I can summarize again, sorry that this is a little stream of consciousness. The first quest, by and large, was trying to repudiate the Christ of faith and say, let's find a historical man of Nazareth. The second quest said, we can't do that, but Jesus is still important to people. Why is that? And people with personal religious commitment, like Rudolf Bultmann said, it was just God working among us, and we just tried to understand that the best we can. People in the ancient world did it the way they wrote these texts. We do it the way we preach Jesus. The third quest was interested in coming up with what I would call a new Jesus. There's a real tendency of current scholars to find a model for Jesus, which is not Son of God or Christ, or just, you know, Jewish preacher that later Christians made into the Son of God, and fit him into that mold. So, for instance, when it's very popular with someone like Bart Ehrman or E.P. Sanders, is Jesus as an apocalyptic prophet. He's operating in a Jewish context, but he thought he was at the end of times from a Jewish perspective, and he was trying to get people ready for that. Marcus Bohr, Geza Fermi's 12th Tree, they think that he's a charismatic healer. Cresson, if some of you know Cresson, Jean-Dominique Cresson, he thought Jesus was fitting into the model of a Greek cynic philosopher. N.T. Wright sees him as someone who thought he was the Jewish Messiah. There's a guy named Richard Horsley, who's a would-be Roman historian. I use that term loosely in his case. He likes to see Jesus as a social prophet, a revolutionary, someone who's trying to overthrow the order in the Roman occupation.
And he'll become important when we talk about Reza Aslan, you know, who's very, very much in the news.
But the point is, they're all taking evidence, both in the canon and outside of the canon. They're looking at it using historical
criteria. Eric, I realize I'm biased, you know, because my professors, of course, are Bart Ehrman and E.P. Sanders. But the way that I perceive current discussion on the historical Jesus, and I'd like to hear your feedback, is there's kind of an academic Schweitzer influence, you know, Jesus as apocalyptic prophet, the kind of Jesus that you see in introductions to the New Testament. And then you see the Jesus Seminar, you know, who I would put in the category of kind of very, very skeptical about the Gospels, privileging extra-canonical literature a little bit. And then you have the mythicists, who, I don't know about you, but I'm baffled by how big they're getting. You know, these people who say Jesus never existed. And we'll get to that in a moment. And then kind of you have the freelance type people. You know, I would put Reza Aslan in that category. And then I would also add in, I don't know where you would put N.T. Wright and the more evangelical and Catholic scholarship.
Yeah, N.T. Wright, Ben Witherington, Craig Evans, what they tend to do is, and this is actually where I would put myself if I were professionally involved in historical Jesus studies, is what I like to term the fourth quest, which is using the academic methodologies and criteria to show that the Jesus of faith is coherent with the historical Jesus, that the evidence we have does not disprove the salient and important parts. The only group I think you missed there, as you were talking about the different third questers, and this is mostly because of my current work on the miracles of Jesus, Grant Twelvetree, I don't know if you know him, John Meyer, marginal Jew, they see him as a charismatic healer. And this was very interesting to me. The third quest began to say the purpose of a historian is not to determine whether something was possible or not, right? In the first quest, there are no miracles. Thomas Jefferson cut all the miracles out of his version of the Bible because it's not possible. But historians today say our purpose is not to say whether miracles are possible. Our job is to determine whether Jesus and the people around him thought he performed miracles. And so you have people like Grant Twelvetree and John Meyer who say, there's no doubt that Jesus was a charismatic healer, that he healed people, whether it was faith healing or folk practices. They also say exorcisms happen. Now, they don't necessarily believe in evil spirits, but they say that maybe you have, you know, psychological, emotional disturbances, and Jesus was able to help ameliorate those. So that's a group that's actually pretty important that I wouldn't necessarily put in the Sanders and Ehrman camp.
Yeah, and Sanders actually puts that Jesus was known as a miracle worker. I actually think he's said Jesus is a miracle worker.
He's a bridge into what Twelvetree and Meyer do.
Yeah, as one of the main things that we can be sure about.
But, Lindsay, this probably seemed like a really long-winded survey of historical Jesus studies, but the reason I wanted to lay that out for you is because you expressed an interest, you know, in knowing what we can actually know about Jesus. And here I'm going to be a little second questy and like Rudolf Bultmann. Whether we can know or not doesn't change anything as a man of faith, or in your case, as a woman of faith, because if Jesus existed and he is real to you, it should change you. And the teachings attributed to him should make you think. And I believe through spiritual means, you can find out what his teachings were.
I have a caveat to add to that.
Sure, please.
I agree with that in principle. But what I see as a dangerous aspect of that is, you know, when Christianity seeks to shape laws based on what we think Christ said. I mean, we don't do that with Socrates said this, so that means we have to make this law. I see that with the gay marriage debate. I see that with apartheid. You know, we've used the Bible to subjugate and hurt people based on what we think Jesus said. And that's where I think it gets dangerous. And that's why I bring it up.
You know, I think the answer to people misusing Jesus, whether it's the historical Jesus, the Jesus of faith, or the actual Jesus, is to not cut Jesus out of the public conversation, but to bring up the other sides of Jesus that partisans of one position fail to see. And I often will tell my students at BYU, how would Jesus treat person X, Y, or Z? So I think the real answer there is to, I don't want to say go on the offensive, but maybe I do, is to be forthright and convicted in the Jesus teachings, which are about love, tolerance, empowerment, and social justice. I'm not a big person to fight against things. I like to build things up.
That's good stuff. Lindsay, I want to go deeper into your concern. And one thing that I like to do for clarity is I like to distinguish problems in Mormonism, you know, because that's our tradition, problems in religion, and then problems in human nature. And I think what you just described is actually a problem of human nature. So there's no way around it. I mean, there are ways of dealing with it. And I think I like Eric's suggestion of using the authoritative texts to challenge the discourse. But it is very normal as human beings. It's natural for us to try to use authoritative sources to prove that we're right, to try to get, to try to make happen things that we value. And so this is where I think that academia can be useful, is you said, oh, so you believe in the Bible and you believe in Jesus. Well, what do you think about this? And not in an adversarial Bible bashing way. I hate the whole like sling versus at each other game. But if it can be constructive to say, well, what do you think about this teaching, or how do you think that this applies to what you're trying to do? Or you can appeal to other authoritative sources, such as, well, how do you think that we can use the Bible and talk about the Bible in a pluralistic democracy, such as what America is. But you're right that it is a concern. One provocative statement that I like to make and talk about is I would submit that virtually no one believes in the Bible. They believe in their idea of the Bible. Right. And that is what they use rhetorically and interpersonally.
But yeah, Jared, I wanted to ask you a question about that. Mm-hmm. And it's a question that comes up. I mean, you said that you wish people would know the scripture, focus more on the scripture a little bit more. And I think that that's absolutely accurate. I feel like a lot of Christians don't even know what's in the Bible. Myself included, I'm still studying it. You know, after like a lifetime of studying it, I still don't know what's in the Bible. And I feel like the Old Testament Jesus is completely different than the New Testament Jesus. And I feel like there are a lot of...
Well, there's not an Old Testament Jesus, right?
Thank you, Eric.
The story
was just like...
right. But in Mormonism...
There's an Old Testament Yahweh that LDS theology identifies with the premortal Jesus.
I like to call it the God will spit you out of his mouth Jesus.
Right.
But that's in Revelation 4. So, you know, that's something I think is really important, is because when people talk about the Old Testament Yahweh being this God of judgment and the New Testament God being the God of love and the Jesus of love, they're being selective with their text again. You know, the most common epithet for Yahweh in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible, has nothing to do with judgment or strength or power. It's chesed. It's loving kindness. And the New Testament, which we trumpet as being this loving God and this loving Jesus, has Ananias and Sapphira dropping dead in the book of Acts because they lied to Peter. It has the Lamb of God who was slain coming back as the Lion of Judah, destroying people in the book of Revelation. So we need to be honest that all Scripture, Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants, Hebrew Bible, Greek New Testament, portrays God in a multiplicity of ways. And I think Jared's exactly right. We tend to focus on those portraits or aspects of God that we find conducive or palatable or familiar.
Yeah, we're always selective, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think that ethics should be a driving force too.
But Jared, this is the point I made earlier, and this is why I brought Heidegger up. Just be honest with it.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to bring the Bible into discussion, say, I believe that this is what the Bible is saying. Now, I'm a Latter-day Saint, so I do believe 15 men, when they're united, have the authoritative position of laying that out for me. But as I always tell my students, as we're looking at scriptural text, there are the absolutes, the probables, and the possibles. And the absolutes are a pretty small set. God is real. He makes a difference in our lives. Jesus Christ saved us. As a Latter-day Saint, I believe Joseph Smith is a prophet, and I believe in the restoration. It's all these probables what the scriptures mean and what person X said that teaching Y meant. And then the possibilities become legion. And that's actually where a lot of the historical Jesus people, particularly the Jesus seminar people, get off on, is all these tiny little possibilities, which from a position of faith have really no merit. They're not salvific. They don't save us, nor do they change how we treat each other or how we live in a community.
Yeah, Eric, one thing that I think is extremely useful, and this goes directly to your point, Lindsay, is I think the very first thing that we need to allow is we need to allow Scripture to disagree with itself.
Right.
And I don't even like the singular there, you know, because the Scriptures are anthologies. You know, the Bible is absolutely, it's a library. It's a library of books. And we, a lot because of Jesus the Christ, you know, we have inherited what's called a harmonistic approach, and I call that Jesus soup. That's like blended together. You know, will Jesus blend? Where it's like all, and then it's overlaid by correlation. Of course, you know, the selective correlation of this picture and with some Greg Olson paintings on the side. And so the first thing, and again, this challenge and be challenged by, is that we need to open our minds to the idea that the Jesus that we read in Mark is going to be different than the Jesus we read in Luke, is going to be different than the Jesus we read in John, which is going to be different than the Jesus we read in the Book of Mormon. And what I like doing with that, and I think it's very productive, is I like reading the scriptures carefully and then asking ourselves, well, what does this mean about revelation? What does this mean about the nature of scripture? You know, what does this mean? What can we conclude about how God works with us? You know, what can we conclude?
What does it mean about the polyvalence of who Jesus actually is? That he can be, now sorry, this is the Christian in me just spilling out all over.
Go for it.
All things to all people.
Yeah.
Jesus is there for everyone.
You're conflating Jesus and Paul, but go with it.
Well, no.
I mean, I love that verse.
I'm channeling my inner Paul here, even though I'm usually Johannine. Let's go back to the different portraits of Jesus, just for Dan and Lindsay's amusement, if nothing else. You know, I always tell my students, Gospel Mark is the Harry Potter gospel. You know, it's like a fun novel full of magic, and it's exciting, and you get swept along by the story. And then Jesus is this John Wayne Jesus. He's a good guy. He's strong. He's manly. But he's a little rough around the edges. The Matthean Jesus is very much like some of these third questers see him, an apocalyptic prophet, if you will, perhaps a Messiah figure. We usually call him in church education context, the Jewish Jesus. The Lucan Jesus, from an LDS perspective, I like to call the primary Jesus, because this is the Jesus we grew up with. He loves us. He's kind. He's healing. The Johannine Jesus is God made flesh. He's the incarnate
Super Jesus.
He's super Jesus. The Book of Mormon Jesus goes back and forth between it being a Pauline and a Johannine Jesus, and I'm just fine with that. Not that we have a favorite gospel, but if we did, it would be John. So I'm fine with the Book of Mormon Jesus being God and what he did for us, Christ crucified, being the saving and only important thing. So I think it's great that we have this multiplicity. Richard Holtzapfel put it this way when he wrote about the Passion Narrative some years ago. He says it's like a stained glass window or facets of a diamond. And I actually like the breadth of the portrayals of Jesus, because it's like when I read the Sermon on the Mount, it reminds me, I like what you said, Jared, continually challenged by this. When I teach Matthew 5 through 7, I always tell students, you know, Harold B. Lee liked to call it the Constitution of the Christians. I said, well, guess what? You know the Constitution of the Christian as well as you know the U.S. Constitution. You need to read it, be challenged with it, be concerned about 3/8 of a person at one point in our history. You need to be concerned that Jesus is asking you to do hard things. You shouldn't read it and be smugly, wow, I'm a good guy or good gal. But rather, I need to change. I need to look at things differently. And the fact that there are so many portrayals of Jesus reminds me that I believe he's an infinite being. And you mentioned this earlier, Lindsay, in another setting, maybe we can talk about this. But the fact that he represents the best of gender qualities, of traditional male and traditional female ones. I mean, he is ontologically rich. And whether that's simply my Jesus of faith, or the actual Jesus who is being interpreted and understood by different peoples in different texts at different times differently, doesn't matter to me. It means that this Jesus is worth a lifetime trying to get to know.
That was very moving. Can we take a step back, Dan? And sure. Can I talk about sources for a bit?
In fact, I was going to take you there.
I also have a question. Can I ask a follow-up really quick?
Yeah, do it while we're thinking about it.
Yeah, Eric, that reminded me. For the feminist audience out there, I was wondering if, comparing all the different gospel Jesuses, which one you thought would be the most friendly to women, most feminist friendly, because, you know, women in ancient Rome couldn't hold property, they couldn't vote, they lived...
Oh, Lindsay, I've got to jump in and smack it down there, sister. Jewish women were very constrained, Greek women were very constrained, Roman women had the greatest social, political, and economic standing in the ancient world, at least in the Western world.
Yeah, but I mean, we're comparing like crumbs to smaller crumbs.
Okay. Okay, well, let me just address your
question.
You're
disagreeing with a Roman historian, Lindsay.
Lindsay, Luke's your man. Luke, I always say that we don't have a favorite gospel, and if we did, it would be John, and if we had a second favorite, it would be Luke. And let me tell you why I love Brother Luke.
Luke is my favorite.
Luke, this gospel is the gospel of the underdog. And Luke remembers and or recollects or privileges stories and teachings about Jesus that I think matched his own temperament, whoever the author of Luke was. He's concerned about the marginalized, which means the poor, the oppressed, women, in a Jewish context, Gentiles. And you will have more stories about women, positive stories about women in Luke than you will anywhere else. Even in the infancy narrative that I've done quite a lot of work on, Luke's gospel is very careful to pair male characters with female characters. So you have Zacharias and Elizabeth, Mary and Joseph, Simeon and Hannah. So you always have a woman doing the same thing
that she's a prophetess, right? Very, very high status.
School of Deborah and Huldah. And, you know, even in the miracle stories that I'm currently working on, Luke will go out of his way to have a woman be healed or helped to match a male. So if the man with the withered hand happens in one chapter, in the next chapter, there'll be the bent over woman with osteoporosis. So Luke's your man, but John is your next favorite guy. He has fewer stories about women, but they are powerful ones.
And Jesus is the most feminine in John. You have this extremely provocative imagery where Jesus says in John 16, I am going to give birth, basically.
Yep, absolutely. And John 7, where the streams of living water coming out of his belly, it's the same word Nicodemus uses in John 3 for womb. So, yeah, John's great. You've got powerful figures like the woman at the well. You have, of course, Martha. For all the Marthas in the church, which would be my grandmother, my mother, my sister, and my wife, who always are offended that Mary gets to sit at the feet. I like to call John 11 Martha's revenge, because it's clear when she was making dinner, she was listening. Because when she's dialoguing with Jesus about Lazarus's death, Martha knows the whole gospel plan and has a testimony of it, whereas Mary's just bawling. So yeah, John's got great characters, not the least of which, and here is my crypto-Catholic coming out, is the mother of Jesus. Never named, but, you know, wedding at Cana, John 2, at the foot of the cross, John 19. You know, in our tradition, because we are so blessed with special witnesses of Christ, we look at the 12 in the Gospels as saying, these are the ultimate witnesses of Jesus. I'll tell you the ultimate witness of Jesus was. It was his mom. These Jesus scholars may never get to the bottom of who the Jesus of past was, but I can assure you Mary knew him. And she is the best witness of his divine conception, miraculous birth, his first miracle, that his saving death. Last time we see her is in the upper room in Acts 1. Oh, Lindsay, there. So, you know, I have a daughter, Lindsay, and my soft feminist is going to come out here. I have a daughter, and I remember sitting with her at the bus stop when she was about 10, and we were reading Paul together, which is probably the wrong text to be reading with a girl. And she said, Daddy, why doesn't God like girls as much as boys? And I resolved right then I was going to find every single woman in Scripture and privilege her and teach her. My students even know this. If there is a woman in a text, they know it's going to be on the reading quiz the next day. And Luke and John are going to give you the figures, Lindsay, I think that you and our sisters want.
I love that. Awesome. Thank you for that.
Awesome.
That was beautiful.
Hey, guys. Well, let's just jump in a little bit here. This has been amazing. I know we wanted to do sources. So, Jared, I'm going to turn to you for sources.
Hey, Jared, then, why don't you do sources, and I will do historical criteria and maybe Craig Evans's control on those. Does that sound like a plan?
Yeah, let's talk sources. Before we move away from feminism, I think that we also, Eric mentioned this briefly, but we'll jump ahead to what we can know about Jesus, and I'm definitely in the apocalyptic prophet camp. Not that that is mutually exclusive from others. I mean, I think that he was a miracle worker, and he was a charismatic teacher, and he was other things as well, but it's in this idea of reversal. I mean, my very favorite statement about Jesus, and I've said this before, is, and it's Bart Ehrman's wording, but it's, he lived as if the kingdom had already come. And I think that there's no more beautiful call for us.
Eschatology.
What?
Realized eschatology.
Yeah, but also a symbolic prefigurement of the Messianic era. You know, this idea that not exactly realized eschatology in that we are already enjoying the benefits of the coming age, but that it is our faith and our symbolic actions that are bringing about the symbol, you know, about the coming age. And I think that's what Jesus was doing. And so he, as best we can tell, I mean, women are the closest witnesses to his crucifixion and his resurrection. You know, Mary Magdalene has been called the apostle to the apostles. Apostle means one sent forth. But so it feels like crumbs sometimes, you know, I know, but in the Gospels, there is a lot to work with as far as women. Okay, so we've Eric's testimony of the Jesus of faith was absolutely moving, so I'm really glad we have that. So moving more to the historical Jesus, this question of what can we know about Jesus and what sources do we have to work with? It's useful to organize this. Let's limit ourselves to about the first 100 years after Jesus' death. I mean, obviously, there are tons of sources, quote unquote, about Jesus, even including like Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ or, you know, Jesus Christ Superstar. I mean, those are sources about Jesus, right? I mean, every children's book is about Jesus. But when we're talking about history, you know, we need to limit ourselves to early sources. Earlier the better, and we need to be aware of biases. And the teaser, basically, the Gospels are as good as it gets. But let's take a step back. Believers may be somewhat surprised by how unknown Jesus was. Jesus just wasn't that big a deal, you know, as far as the wider world goes. Obviously, Jesus is perhaps the best known figure in the entire world now, but he just wasn't talked about much. And I actually subvert this a little bit, and I think that the fact Jesus was not very known is both evidence he did exist and evidence he was not invented. I don't even know what book that was. It circulated on Facebook a while ago. The whole, like, Jesus was an invented Roman conspiracy. And I just laughed at that. I'm like, this is so absurd. That's like saying the CIA invented Vernon Howell, otherwise known as David Koresh, to placate the Americans. You're like, what? It wasn't a big enough deal. So we have a couple pagan sources that don't tell us much at all. Suetonius is debated whether or not he's even talking about Jesus is in about 115. He said, since the Jews constantly made disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, he expelled them from Rome. So is Crestus a guy named Crestus, or is it a mispronunciation of Christos or Christus? Who knows? But we don't know anything about that people revolted because of Christ. Pliny writes a letter to Trajan because the Christians won't worship the emperor. All we know is that Christians sing a hymn to Christ as to a god. Again, we don't learn anything about that.
I'd say Pliny is more of a source of early Christians. It's not saying anything about the history of Jesus.
Exactly. Now, Tacitus, in about 115, you know, famous Roman historian, we do get a little bit of information to work with here. In his annals. And interestingly, you know, Tacitus also reveals what Romans thought about Christians, basically that it was a gross superstition, a disgusting superstition. So this is what Tacitus said. Consequently, this is the story of Nero. To get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, and a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. Accordingly, an arrest was first made in all who pleaded guilty, and then upon their information, the immense multitude was convicted not so much of the crime of firing the city, setting the city on fire, as of hatred against mankind. I like pointing out the irony that Christians were first persecuted for atheism and for antisocial behavior, because in American culture, it's so much the opposite. So all we learn from Tacitus, this is interesting information. You know, it's good to have confirmed that Christ or Jesus was crucified under Pontius Pilate and then founded a religion. But again, we don't learn anything new. Eric, do you have anything to say about the historical value of Tacitus?
Well, Tacitus, you know, is a little problematic from a Roman historical point of view because he has such a bias against the emperors that we have to be very careful what he says about the various Julio-Claudians. But that raises an issue that we talked about with Lindsay and Dan earlier, that historians always had agenda. And so we know he's not always reliable on Roman imperial history. But this is an example of something so offhanded, why would he be making it up? Right. The only thing that's a problem with that particular passage is he gets the title wrong for Pontius Pilate. He calls him a procurator. And we know from documentary evidence that the Roman governors before Claudius were called prefects. But does that invalidate what he says about Jesus being executed? No.
Yeah, so, you just offhandedly listed a very important criterion of offhandedness. Right. It's this idea that because everyone has biases, and first we need to know that basically there exists nothing but historical fiction, especially in the ancient world. Historical fiction is the closest genre to what ancient history was. And you can joke and say even modern history is historical fiction. But we have a tighter methodology, at least. When authors mention things in a really offhanded way, they are more reliable, and we'll get to this with Josephus, than when they're making a point. Because when they're, if I were trying to prove my cousin's innocence, and I said, no, you know, my cousin wasn't there at the scene of the crime, his girlfriend mentioned that he was at a bar, he absolutely is innocent. Whether he's innocent is up for debate, because that's the point that I'm really trying to make, but that he has a girlfriend, there's no weight to that. You know, I'm just casually mentioning it. And so I would also agree that this statement by Jesus, or about Jesus, is historically solid, because Tacitus's point isn't about Jesus. He just casually mentions that he was crucified. His main point is about Nero and the Christians.
Right.
So that's it. That is it for pagan sources.
Can I ask you a question really quick?
Yes, Lindsay. Yes.
Sorry to keep breaking in. I was just curious about conflict of interest. If we know about the historians writing this, so my understanding is that the historians were the privileged ones. They're the ones that could read and write. Usually the poor people could not. So what would be their, I guess, their bias in writing about a man who stood up for the poor and who kind of wanted to topple this sort of, I guess, a social justice Jesus?
If they knew about Jesus, that was my point. That would be a concern. But, you know, Suetonius and Tacitus, Pliny the Younger here doesn't really apply, but Suetonius and Tacitus, the two that talk about Christus and Christians, I think their social bias would not be so much the social justice preaching of Jesus as it would be the people who were attracted to the Jesus movement tended to be low class. So you have the Jews as a religious and ethnic minority in the city of Rome. They're causing problems. It's associated with this guy named Christus. Must be bad. When Tacitus says these Christians are hated by all people, really? All people in Rome? Or is it the senators and the equites and the people who hate the lower class people anyway? And so you have a new movement among that group. So I think you're right, Lindsay, to sense that there is a social bias, but I think it's assuming too much of that they knew too much about the teachings of Jesus. I think what they saw was the Jesus movement included people they saw disreputable, so it couldn't have been a good movement.
Yeah,
not Stoic philosophy like the upper class people would be attracted to.
Yeah, that's a great summary. In a word, these authors, which actually works for our benefit when we're trying to figure out historicity, they were dismissive. They were so dismissive of Jesus that they didn't even pay attention. Okay, now we're going to get to what's probably, well, not probably, the most important non-Christian witness to the historicity of Jesus and some of the actions of Jesus, and that is Josephus. And Josephus is incredibly controversial because he was a traitor. He was a traitor in the first Jewish war. He was a turncoat, and he went over to the Romans. And so as a result, it was not the Jews who transmitted the writings of this Jewish historian. It was the Christians who transmitted the writings of this Jewish historian. And they were mostly excited because Josephus talks about Jesus. And Josephus is incredibly valuable for us understanding Judaism at the time of Jesus. And he also provides a lot of other information, and he has his own biases and so forth. So there are two mentions of Jesus in Josephus. One is in Antiquities. Antiquities is this massive, you know, magnum opus where he tells the entire story of the world up until his time. And in 20.9.1, this is one of those casual side mentions because he's actually talking about James, the brother of Jesus. And Josephus spends more time talking about John the Baptist than Jesus, which is interesting in and of itself. But in 20.9.1, he just says that James, the brother of Jesus who was called Christ, whose name was James, and some others, when he had formed an accusation against them, the high priest, as breakers of the law, he delivered them to be stoned. So again, you have this very casual mention of Jesus because he's really talking about Jesus' brother, James. So I think that, again, is solid evidence that Jesus existed, but it doesn't tell us much. It doesn't tell us anything more than he had a brother named James. Now,
it's interesting, though, before you go on to the next one, Jerry, where there are problems in Antiquities 18, but in Antiquities 20, the offhandedness with which he says the brother of Jesus who was called Christ, He didn't say who is the Christ. Who he just yeah. says, oh, people called him that, which does suggest that there were people either at the time of Jesus' ministry or shortly thereafter who saw him as Messiah figure. So that in itself may be significant.
Yeah, and I want to get back to this because I think it's really solid. I want to discuss who did Jesus think he was, you know, as toward the end. So here is the really sticky quote from Josephus. It's Antiquities 18.3.3. And the full text is, "Now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works," that's miracles, "a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men among us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. And the tribe of Christians, so named from him, are not extinct at this day." Now, what we should say about this is there was a later Christian tradition that Josephus converted. Of course, there's also a tradition that Pilate converted. I mean, you know, we all want people to believe in Jesus. And so the options with this passage, no one thinks that Josephus actually wrote it. Because Josephus, or the whole thing rather, Josephus was a Jew. He was a Jewish historian. There are several comments that he would never have made. You know, Josephus as a Jew would never have said, "Oh, you can't call Jesus a man. He was the Messiah. He was resurrected." So the debate is whether or not this entire passage is an interpolation, you know, someone was added it in, or whether it was just added to. I mean, we can't get into the nitty-gritty. Do you have anything to say about those options, Eric?
Yeah, I mean, the parts that people usually cut out, as you say, are the line, "if it be lawful to call him a man." And there I'd clarify, not, you know, as opposed to the Son of God or divine. I think you could call him Messiah, and that doesn't necessarily mean in Jewish context that he's not right. a man. He was the Christ, which is different from the earlier reference that you cited, where it says he was called the Christ. This is just kind of proclaiming it. And then that whole section beginning, "for he appeared to them alive, testified of the resurrection, divine prophets that they're told it," etc., etc. So the usual assumption is a later Christian scribe copying Josephus has added these phrases in. Or, as you say, it's possible the whole thing. But the parts that we haven't excerpted, the fact that Jesus was a wise man is what we call coherent with other evidence we have about Jesus, that he was considered a teacher, doing wonderful works. We seem to have evidence of that. Drew after him Jews and Gentiles. So I incline to the side that the passage has its origins with Josephus, and a later Christian scribe has added to it. I think there is something genuine in the passage as a whole.
Yeah, so do I. And the way that I describe, so one second, the way that I describe the work of history is that you try to make a coherent narrative that best explains all available evidence. You know, which reconstruction best explains everything else. And I think it's very plausible that Josephus would, that if a Christian scribe came across this passage, you know, the Christian scribe would have just been beside himself in excitement about so much about Jesus. It would have been very understandable that the Christian, "Oh yeah, you know, Josephus is talking about my man, you know, this is the money passage." It's very understandable that a Christian would have said, you know, "this time Jesus, a wise man," and then in this, said, "whoa, you can't call him a man." It's very understandable that the scribe would have added in these exact sections, but that it would have been, there would have been that kernel. But again, even with Josephus, we just don't learn much. From a historical perspective, it would be interesting to know and have confirmed that he did preach to Gentiles, because that's something that's up for debate, you know, in the Gospels. And at the suggestion of the principal men among us, that suggests some level of culpability with the Jewish leadership. Like, those would be historically interesting. Lindsay, what question do you have?
Yeah, no, I was just asking for a defining of terms there, because, you know, for Sunstone, we're having the Christ Conference, and I know that there was some controversy there calling it that. And I know as Mormons, especially growing up, we just kind of interchange Jesus Christ as if Christ was his surname.
His last name, right?
Yeah, so can you give me the difference between the terms Jesus, Christ, and Messiah, and how calling him a man or Jesus or Christ, how those differ?
Can I grab that one, Jared?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, the man of Nazareth was named Yeshua or Yehoshua, which is Hebrew for Joshua. In the Greek, its Greek form is Jesus. That is his given name. Christos is the Greek term meaning the anointed one. It's the equivalent of the Hebrew Mashiach for Messiah. So Jesus was not known really at all during his mortal ministry as Mashiach or the Christ. I mean, in Mark's gospel, except for the introduction, it appears the first time in Peter's declaration in Mark 8 at Caesarea Philippi. So it's not something that was used regularly, even by his disciples as they came to believe in him during his life. I have a personal kind of stylistic guide. Whenever I'm talking about Jesus in the Gospels, I always call him Jesus. And whenever I talk about the risen Lord, I call him Jesus Christ. I mean, that sounds like a strange parsing of terms, but I think it's kind of important. My students find this odd, but when they write about the Gospels, I say the Gospels are your style guide. So if the text referred to him as Jesus, I want you to refer to him as Jesus. The reason why, Lindsay, I think we interchange them so much in the LDS tradition is out of respect, right? Jesus Christ is more respectful. In fact, a lot of times we'll substitute titles for his name: the Savior, the Lord, the Redeemer.
Can I step in a little bit?
Yeah.
Historically, so Jesus would have been known as Jesus of Nazareth. Yeshu is actually closer to the Aramaic because the final sound dropped off. But so Jesus of Nazareth, if you were from
Yeshu and Joseph, he would have been called Jesus the son of Joseph or Jesus son of Mary if there was a question.
I don't want to get too much into this. As I understand it, if you were in the Judea area, you were called by the patronymic. But he was known as Jesus, son of Mary, which is super interesting that where's the dad? But usually, as I understand it, Judeans, you know, so urban guys, were known by the name of their parent, their father. So, you know, Jesus, son of Joseph. And if you were rural, you would be called by your hometown. And Nazareth was so small that Jesus of Nazareth would actually be useful. Or similarly, Mary of Magdala. You know, that's what Mary Magdalene means. It means Mary of Magdala. So when you're talking about rural areas, usually they were called by their hometown. So you could choose from this. So Jesus was his name. Wouldn't have a last name. He'd either be called, you know, Jesus, son of Joseph, or Jesus of Nazareth. And Jesus of Nazareth is what the most common title as far as in the Gospels, and that seems to be the most historically accurate. And I personally think, I don't know if we want to jump ahead now, but I think simply the term Jesus of Nazareth proves he existed.
Right.
Because
right.
You would, that was like, oh, it's Jesus of Moscow. Oh, you know, Moscow, Russia? No, Moscow, Idaho. Like, yeah. you didn't even know Jesus of Nazareth existed.
It's Moscow's too big. It's Hurricane.
Yeah.
Nice.
No, exactly. So people wouldn't have even known.
Because if you were making up a Messiah, you would say Jesus of Bethlehem, right?
Yeah, and I don't think Jesus was born in Bethlehem, but that's
what I'm saying, though. If you were making it up, Jared, you would not pick an out-of-the-way, unknown town in Galilee.
Correct. Exactly. So let me fill out a couple other things. We'll talk about this a little bit more, but Messiah, you know, Mashiach means anointed. And the surprising thing for Christians, because later Christians, by the time the New Testament was written, they had mashed together all of these titles. You know, so it was Jesus Christ, Son of God, Savior, you know, Redeemer, Lord, all of these things. But it actually meant different things. So Messiah meant different things to different people. Historically, a Messiah wasn't necessarily a cosmic figure, and neither was Son of God, interestingly. The fundamental idea of Messiah or Son of God is a chosen special servant of God. You know, so God's favorite person who is going to help do God's work. And the Messianic era was the restoration of a paradise state onto the earth. And that was actually Jesus' primary message, is that you need to repent and you need to put yourself right with God by living my interpretation of the Jewish law, which is love God, love your neighbor. Don't let the minutiae of Jewish law interfere with loving God or loving your neighbor in preparation for the coming kingdom of God that is going to happen right away. Now, there's one more title, which is Son of Man.
Yeah.
And Son of Man does seem to be a cosmic figure. And again, we can go more into detail in this later.
Well, in Daniel and perhaps in their mental literature, but not Ezekiel, right? Son of Man and Ezekiel.
Son of Man is a human being. But by the time of Jesus, Messiah meant God's servant who is going to restore this perfected state. Other people believed that the Messiah was the perfect lawgiver who would give the perfect interpretation of the Jewish law. You know, other Jews believed that the Messiah was going to be this priestly figure. But as best as we can tell, no one believed that the Messiah was going to die, you know, and be a sacrifice. And in fact, that's an argument for Jesus teaching that he was the Messiah to his disciples, because that both explains why his disciples worked so hard to make Messiah fit, and it also gives us a reason why he was executed. But let me give a summary really quick. So Jesus was what he was called, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus was his name, Yeshu. And Messiah was God's servant who is going to fix the world. And we have reason to think that Jesus taught that he was the Messiah, and that his followers believed he was the Messiah. Son of God would have been similar to Messiah, where it's like, you know, again, in a special relationship with God. And super interestingly, one trajectory in early Christianity is, when did Jesus become God's son? And in our earliest layer, the best we can tell, Jesus was vindicated by being resurrected by God. You know, so that's when Jesus became God's son, is when he was resurrected. And then a little bit later, and different people and different sources, they believe that Jesus was adopted as God's son at the beginning of his ministry. You know, so when he was baptized. In fact, our earliest manuscripts of Luke say not, "This is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased." It says, "This is my beloved son," you know, or it says, "You are my son, today I have adopted you,"
which yeah, actually both Mark and Luke, even in our King James, say, "Thou art my
yes.
beloved son." It's only Matthew says, "This is my beloved son."
Mm-hmm. Good.
We tend to misremember that because of first vision, I think.
Yes. And then we have the birth narratives, you know, where God was Jesus's father from his birth. And then we have pre-existent Christology, like in John, where it's like Jesus was always God's son. And there were hundreds of years of debates on this, like everything up and through the Nicene Creed and the Apostolic Creed, it was all debates about, well, how are the Father and the Son exactly related? Okay, now, there is debate about whether or not Jesus considered himself the Son of Man, you know, which was this cosmic figure who is going to also help bring about the perfection of creation. By the time the Gospels were written, the Gospel writers absolutely thought that Jesus was the Son of Man, but it's debated whether Jesus himself. So is that at all clear? There's a lot of information.
Yeah, no, that's good for me. Now, I've heard the one little piece that even the emperors, the Roman emperors and stuff, were called sons of God. It was yes. on inscriptions and coins. So mm-hmm. there's a line that says that Paul deliberately made the connection with Jesus as the Son of God as sort of a political move.
I disagree. I think it's earlier than that.
Yeah. Okay.
Because there's okay. so much. Okay. Jewish kings were considered sons of God. You know, right. Psalm 2:7 is an enthronement psalm.
Yeah, it's a royal psalm.
Yeah, I mean, Dan, this is, again, this idea of Jesus as a pagan invention and is, I think it overemphasizes or assumes too much about how important Jesus was to pagans, which was not very much at all. Now, there is a legitimate argument that Jesus was understood in pagan ways. You know, that as Christianity spread from Judaism to the pagans, that as the missionaries taught, and then especially as pagans took up the message of Jesus, yes, you know, Jesus would have been framed in ways that were understandable to a pagan audience, or which is a little bit what you were saying. But and I think Paul gets too much credit. Oh, which is a good segue, because we're actually talking
yeah,
about
Paul.
Yeah,
we're going to do Paul next as a source, yeah.
Yeah, I think Paul gets too much credit as like an inventor of Christianity. Now, I do think it's fun and provocative to say, you know, would Jesus have joined Paul's religion? But I just say that to students when I'm teaching to make them think. There is continuity. There's a surprising amount of continuity between like the Jewish Christians who were the enemies of Paul and Paul. They both believed that we are saved through Jesus' death and that Jesus is a sacrifice for our sins. And one thing that we forget is that Paul was a Christian for almost 15 years before we get any letters from him. So he would have learned Christianity. He would have learned everything about Jesus, probably in Antioch, mostly. And so we are getting a developed Christianity that Paul inherited from, again, probably Antiochian Christianity. Now, Paul's innovations that changed the world, I mean, one, he was the most passionate missionary. He was amazing. But his innovation seems to have been, I am going to make completely Gentile communities, you know, completely Gentile congregations. Before Paul's missionary efforts, they were mixed congregations. There were Jewish Christianity, Jewish Christians, and then James was an important figure there. And then there were mixed congregations, most of the Gospels seem to have been written for mixed congregations. And so you have Jews and Gentiles together, whereas Paul was like, God has called me to preach to the Gentiles. And Peter and, you know, James seems to be, okay, whatever, see ya. Anyway, so Paul tells us surprisingly little about the mortal Jesus. He tells us all sorts of things about the crucified and resurrected Jesus. But as far as we can tell, Paul never knew Jesus. And so he only tells us a handful of things. Like you can literally write everything that Paul tells us about the mortal Jesus on a 3x5 card or even smaller.
Paul's a second quester. Nice. It's the fact that Jesus, I proclaim Jesus and him crucified, and that's what saved me. I mean, he has very few sayings of Jesus, teachings of Jesus, or biographical pieces of information.
Yeah, let me lay that out really quick. And I think I have a compelling reason for why he tells us so little. That's one explanation is that what was most important is what he taught. So Galatians 4:4, Jesus was born of a woman as opposed to what? That he was a Jew. 1 Corinthians 9:5 tells us he has brothers. Galatians 1:19, James is Jesus's brother. So that's independent attestation. You know, Josephus and Paul and the Gospels all tell us that Jesus had a brother named James. Romans 15:7, Jesus ministered to the Jews. 1 Corinthians 15:5, he had 12 disciples. 1 Corinthians 11:23-25, he instituted the Lord's Supper. 1 Corinthians 11:23, he was betrayed, maybe, depending on whether it's by Judas or by God. He was crucified. Paul talks about that all the time. This is interesting. 1 Corinthians 7:10-11, Jesus probably taught that believers should never get divorced. That jibes with the Gospels, or a substratum of the Gospels. And then, surprising to members of the church, 1 Corinthians 9:14, Paul says that those who teach the Gospel should be paid. So that's all he says.
The labor of the hire.
The labor's worthy of his hire. And that's actually Paul saying, I am not a freeloader. You know, I am earning my own keep, even though Jesus said that you should support me. So Paul gives us two sayings of Jesus that he taught believers should not get divorced. 1 Corinthians 7:10-11, and also 1 Corinthians 9:14, that those who teach the Gospel should be paid. You know, the labor is worthy of his hire. And those two instances are very interesting because Paul actually goes away from the statement. He doesn't use Jesus' statement to confirm his own ideas. He's like, even though Jesus said this, I'm kind of doing things my own way. Now, the reason why I think Paul said so little about Jesus during his life is because the primary opponents of Paul were Jewish Christians. James, the brother of Jesus, does not seem to have really been a fan of Paul. In fact, Paul is an arch heretic in Jewish Christian writings. And so the way I think of it is that Paul had to rest all of his authority and legitimacy on his own spiritual experience with the vision of Jesus. And so if Paul had tried to argue from, you know, this is what Jesus said and did during his life, his opponents, the Jewish Christians, would have been like, whoa, 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 what are you doing, dude? You know, why are you, we were there, you know, how dare you even bring up these traditions about his, you know, do you want me to go get his brother? You know, so, right. Paul couldn't really use those trump cards, you know, because that was the trump cards. So he reluctantly talks about Jesus' tradition. So it's only when they were having a problem with the communion meal, you know, the Lord's Supper, where he's like, yeah, you know, there was this tradition. But so I think it's very plausible, and it best explains the situation where Paul, of course he would have known tons about Jesus, because again, he was a Christian for 15 years before he writes anything, but he can't legitimize any of his teachings based on mortal teachings, because again, that was someone else. So moving really quick to the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, there are other extra-canonical Gospels. The Gospel of Thomas has the best claim to have some information that may go back to the historical Jesus. But pretty much the Gospels are the best information we have. But the problem is that we can't just take everything that's written in the Gospels at face value. Now, that's how members of the church are used to reading the Gospels, because that's how the Sunday school manuals are written. That's how Jesus the Christ lays it out. And this is like a 1700s and 1800s approach, the harmonistic approach, which is this idea. I think the sayings on the cross is the best way to illustrate it, where it's like, well, you know, Jesus said everything that the Gospels say, you know, and the centurion said, truly this man was the Son of God, and truly this man was innocent. Whereas New Testament scholars say, no, that's probably not how it happened. There were probably these earlier traditions, and then the Gospel writers changed them. So going back to what Eric said earlier, you know, we have Mark's portrayal of Jesus. We have Luke's portrayal of Jesus. We have Matthew's portrayal of Jesus. We have John's portrayal of Jesus. Really quick, Mark was probably written in the late 60s, maybe in 69. I kind of think it's fun if it was ended then. Matthew was written next, you know, in the 80s. Luke maybe 85-ish, and then John in somewhere in the 90s. So these are our stories of Jesus' life were written 40, 50 years after Jesus' death. So again, we need to take very seriously this idea that there's a Markan Jesus, Mark's Jesus, Matthew's Jesus, Luke's Jesus, John's Jesus, and we can look at what they are trying to teach us about Jesus. And if we are going to be historians, if we're going to play, you know, put on our historian hats and be historians, we need to ask ourselves, what is the historical character of each of these Gospels? And then what criteria can we use to sift the Gospels to determine what traditions are most likely to be historically accurate? And let me emphasize something Eric said earlier, that just because all of the historical criteria are limited, they can only usually work in one direction. So we'll be talking about each of these, but just because a historical criterion cannot validate a tradition does not mean it's necessarily unhistorical. Now, that said, that doesn't give us a free pass, you know, as believers. At the same time, we can say that things are less or more probable. Like, as before I pass it off to Eric, one thing that I like saying just as a thought exercise is that the Gospel of John is the most theologically true and the least historically true. And what I mean by that is all Christian literature, especially the Gospels, is a blend of pre-resurrection traditions and post-resurrection traditions. Because shortly after the resurrection, you know, Jesus' death was unexpected. Eric, maybe we can talk about that a little bit, but Jesus's followers did not expect him to die. And I think Jesus began to see that things were not going well. And so toward the end of his life, you know, at his Last Supper, he had just escaped from the police pretty much, and he knew that they were coming for him. So yes, we have some traditions of, you know, I might die. This is how to understand my death. But after his resurrection, or after his followers believed him to be resurrected, they rethought the entire meaning of his ministry. And so that is critical to understand, is that what we have in the Gospels is decades of development where the Christians are seeking to understand Jesus's unexpected death. So we have historical ways of getting at the Gospels. So do you want to talk about that, Eric?
Yeah, well, I just want to throw two different things into that before we move on to criteria. First of all, I've got to get my buddy John off the hook. Well, I certainly agree that he's the most theologically reflective, and hence a lot of historical Jesus students don't put much credence in John. Increasingly, there are scholars who see a lot of interesting historical details in John that we don't see in the other Gospels. So that actually shows us the danger in oversimplifying these issues and saying, well, John's the latest and he's the most theological, so he's the least historical. Because for a long time, in the first historical Jesus quest, no one used John at all, whereas he's increasingly used in the third quest. The other thing I was going to do is just throw in the issue of faith here for those of us who are as or more committed to Jesus, the Christ of faith, than we are the historical Jesus. One of the things that I, as a believer, because I love the text of John and how it stirs my faith, remember that believers take the words of Jesus in the farewell discourses seriously. And so when Jesus in that gospel preaches about the Comforter bringing all things to your remembrance, that the Comforter is the interpreter, that he will teach you all truth, it is not incompatible for a believer to say, yes, even though this Johannine account is 60 or more years later, that reflection and that rethinking, as Jared put it, and that coming to a new understanding about Jesus' death and what he did could come from God. See, that's the point that I have as a believer, and I just want to make sure I... Through that.
Yeah, well, let me restate though. I agree with you that the Gospel of John has historically valuable information, but I was very precise when I said John's portrayal of Jesus is the most theological and the least right. historical. The way that I describe it is, and this is Stephen Robinson, I heard it from Stephen Robinson, I really liked it. We've brought up John Wayne multiple times, where I love Stephen Robinson's answer. He's like, well, you know, I think it's like John Wayne when he filmed The Alamo. You know, someone told him, well, that's not how it happened. You realize that, right? And he's like, well, that's how it should have happened. And so the way that I describe the Gospel of John is it is very much the Christ of faith. It is what would Jesus's ministry have looked like if we knew then what we know now, what we believe now about Jesus. So you are correct. There are historical information there. But I'm saying, and one thing, even if they can remember accurate things, I do think that we need to explain all the available evidence. So for example, if this isn't what you're saying, but if Jesus of Nazareth acted exactly as he's portrayed in John, how on earth do you explain Mark? You know, and so, for example, the causes of Jesus's death, Mark is very, very plausible, you know, where Jesus makes the powers, the Sadducees, who, you know, the priestly power class who had the ears of the Romans, he makes them mad with his temple tantrum, and the Sadducees tip off Pilate that he's a troublemaker, and Pilate demands he's executed.
Likewise, if the raising of Lazarus happened, the reason, the proximate cause that the fourth gospel gives us for the whole effort of the priestly establishment to get him is because too many people are following him because of this miracle.
Right, which I think is historically impossible. But we can move on to the criteria.
Remember, the goal of the historian is not to determine whether something could happen or not. It's whether people thought it.
Believed it, yeah.
Okay, continue. Yeah. But that's I do need to push back hard on this. I disagree. I think that's more like an anthropological approach, and I do think that anthropological influence is beneficial. But when we're talking about the historical Jesus, those are two different things. What did people believe about him, which is the story of Christianity, not Jesus. And the historical Jesus is what did Jesus say and do? So it's almost...
What Jesus said and did is the Jesus of the past. I thought we had established at the beginning of this that the historical Jesus are the sayings and deeds of Jesus
that are most likely to be historically
plausible.
The criteria
that we have yet to enunciate for our audience.
Correct. and so...
Criteria now!
Yeah, so just final thing. To me, it's circular, and it doesn't even give us anything to say what the Gospels say people believed about Jesus. Because, like, well, duh. That's why they were written. You know, so yeah, let's jump into criteria.
Well, no, one last thing and then we will do criteria. I actually
you
think
guys are funny.
It's not just an issue about what Christians in the 60s when Mark was writing thought, or what Christians at the time John was writing, or the fourth evangelist was writing in the 90s thought. It's what did the followers of Jesus at the time think?
Yes. And that is precisely the question that the criteria.
Yeah. Okay. We'll do this quickly because this can become very incoherent for people who aren't familiar with it. These criteria developed over the course of all three of the historical Jesus quests. These are the criteria that people use to look at evidence in the text, both canonical and extra-canonical to decide whether it is showing that something is historically verifiable. And the first one is the idea of multiple attestation, and there's two forms of this: multiple attestation of source and multiple attestation of forms. And the reason why this can get hairy is, even if we're just dealing with the canonical gospels, if something is in Mark and Luke, that does not necessarily count as multiple attestation of source. Right. Because if it is something that Matthew or Luke, if we're assuming Mark in priority and the usual approach to the synoptic question, if
that means Mark was written first.
If there's something in Matthew and Luke that's also in Mark, then Matthew and Luke may have borrowed it from Mark, and it's not an independent attestation of that saying or deed.
Okay. If I can say really quickly, I think the best way to wrap your mind around this historical Jesus and these criteria is, it's like CSI the Bible. You know, yeah. Imagine that
This makes it fun. Regardless of what you believe about him, this should still be fun.
Okay. Yeah, but what I'm saying is, imagine that you're doing a detective story. You know, it's like, what counts as evidence, what counts
The 6,000, even though that's a miracle that most historical Jesus people don't accept, because they're fine with hearing miracles and even exorcisms, but not nature miracles. The fact that it's in Mark and in John 6 is considered multiple attestation, because its appearance in Matthew and Luke, one who accepts the usual approach to the synoptic gospels, they can say they got that from Mark. In John, it appears to be in an independent tradition. Likewise, a lot of the teachings in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5-7, appear independently in the book of James. So those are multiple attestations of source. What's even more interesting, and you have to like form criticism to see this as the case, is that some people posit that in addition to these written documents, that a lot of this material is circulating orally in different kinds of sayings, teachings, parables, etc. So for instance, if you have a miracle that's attested in Mark, but then you have a saying about that miracle that's in Luke and Matthew, but not in Mark, that's what we call multiple attestation of form, because it's in both a narrative source in Mark and it's in something we think circulated separately before Matthew and Luke incorporated it. So what's great is, if you have multiple attestation of sources and forms, historians would say if we have multiple witnesses for this, it is likely that that actually was said or believed to have been done. Jared and I will continue to respectfully disagree on it is
more likely, and it should be said that just because something is attested in one source doesn't mean it is not historically accurate. Right. It's just that it leans in the direction and it helps.
The casing of Lazarus, for instance, is only in John, but it's not in the synoptics. But what
you nerds are missing the bigger point. Do I put a picture of the beefy Jesus breaking the cross on my wall, or do I put a picture of Jesus petting the lamb? That's what the people want to know. Which one is more accurate? Does Jesus have a six pack?
I put the petting the lamb in my kid's room. I put the beefy Jesus in my study, and then I put one in between in the living room. It just depends what you want and what aspect of Jesus is important for you or for the audience that's seeing the picture.
I want Jesus to arm wrestle Satan and win.
Those are terrible, terrible pictures that you're alluding, and now they're in my head. Okay, let's continue. I think this next...
How's your Diet Coke holding out, Lindsay?
Anyway.
Can you tell we're running low?
Yeah, we're
going to push this forward, Lindsay. We're going to get you through this. Okay, as Jared has mentioned, though, just because it's only in one source doesn't mean it isn't true. It simply means it's not as likely by historical criteria.
Or the historical criteria cannot say anything about it. Embarrassment or dissimilarity is the most powerful, so let's get to that one.
Okay, historical coherence we'll deal with real quickly. If something fits the culture and the society and the time period, then it could have happened. You know, some of these,
it is more likely to be historical.
Right. Embarrassment's a great criterion.
Here, can I say one more thing about contextual credibility? And this, we should remember that this is a little bit circular, and that's why history is an art as well as a soft science, is that our judgment about whether something could fit in, you know, first century Galilee or Palestine is limited by our historical accuracy, you know, whether our historical picture of that time period. Famously, New Testament scholars were very skeptical of the Gospel of John, and they said, oh, there's no way that a Jew would have talked like this. This seems very influenced by Greek philosophy, light and dark. And then we found the Dead Sea Scrolls, and we're like, oh my gosh, you know, these very Jewish, very nationalistic people were speaking a lot like the Gospel of John. So again, this is why history needs to be self-correcting, or the academic study
of
history.
And we can't ever lock ourselves into just one model and not continually reassess it.
Nice. Exactly. So it's the soft term, where if it fits within the historical context as we understand it, it is more likely to be historical. Or actually, the way it's usually framed is, if it does not fit into the context as we understand it, it is less likely to be historical. But again, that's where we need to revise our understandings. And the final thing I'll say about this is, I think one of the best ways to get clear on Christian history is to put our traditions in rough chronological order as best we can. That's limited by our ability and our sources. But there are trajectories. You know, for example, Jesus gets more divine, Jews get more guilty, Romans get more innocent, women get more oppressed, and so forth. Although high Christology is very, very, very early, our earliest source. But we can, if a tradition clearly doesn't fit, one of the applications of this is whether it can be back translated into Aramaic, which gets into the whole debate about whether Jesus spoke any Greek. But anyway, that's contextual credibility.
Okay. Embarrassment.
Embarrassment. The criterion of embarrassment suggests that if a saying or deed of Jesus was difficult to understand or explain by the later Christian community, they were not likely to have fabricated or made it up. This doesn't seem like an embarrassing point for us, because we have 2 Nephi 31 talking about Jesus' baptism. But for early Christians, the fact that their Messiah / leader / savior / son of God needed to be baptized by a man who was preaching repentance was kind of awkward. And so most historical Jesus people say he probably was baptized by John the Baptist, because why would they have made that up?
Right. And it also would have implied that Jesus was a follower of John the Baptist.
Right. Some of the sayings of Jesus, you know, Jared's already mentioned, you know, I've come to bring division and not, you know, union. And anyway, so if something is hard saying of Jesus, good possibility it's true.
Yeah, and I actually think this criterion of embarrassment, dissimilarity, we've been using embarrassment, not dissimilarity, because dissimilarity you can push too hard. I mean, yeah, Jesus came from a Jewish context, and Christianity is based on Jesus. Therefore, there is going to be continuity.
Explained dissimilarity? I don't think we've explained it yet.
Maybe
it's early on in the episode, but dissimilarity is if a teaching or deed of Jesus does not fit the Jewish context, and or does not fit the following Christian context. So if it's unique, then it could have just grown up out of a Jewish context and could have been manufactured by a later Christian context. Dissimilarity, in my view, is only good for verifying that something could have happened. It is bad at proving that something couldn't have happened.
Yeah, and most of these only work in one direction. So the way that I describe this to students is I say, we tell things either because they are true or we want them to be true. And I personally think that the criterion of embarrassment is a very powerful argument for the historicity of Jesus. Because if Jesus' followers were going to invent an ideal figure, they would have done a better job. You know, they would not, because we have in our traditions these traditions of Jesus was executed as a criminal. Jesus was baptized by this famous guy, you know, John. Jesus was betrayed by one of his closest disciples. And we can literally see in the Gospels people struggling with these traditions, and they need to explain them. They need to bend over backwards to explain them. And so I think that is very powerful. The analogy that I give is, if I were asking my students, I forgot to take attendance on Monday, who was here on Monday? And I jot down those who say they were here, and I believe them. But if I said, who was not here on Monday, that is the criterion of embarrassment. The students are acting against their own self-interest. And Christians do the same thing, you know, where we have this handful of sources where Christians are acting against their own self-interest. They are telling us traditions that go against their current understanding of Jesus because it's more likely to be historically true. I think that's very powerful.
Awesome. Oh boy, you guys, we're having a good time here, and you two are hilarious just with your tag teams on top of each other. I do need to bring this to a close, and so in the next 20, 30 minutes max, let's just kind of take a look at the question of, so who is Jesus? What are the different models for what he is? And Jared, you and I started talking about doing this podcast a few months ago when one of my listeners wrote to me and was just sort of wrestling with Riza Aslan's book, Zealot, which many of you know has gotten quite a lot of press over the last little while. He's a Muslim scholar who wrote a book about Jesus, and the title Zealot is basically his conclusion that Jesus was a political person trying to overthrow the Roman government, and he kind of comes in as not really a biblical scholar, more of a sociologist and creative writing teacher. And anyway, lots of weird things happened, and he got this boost from a wonderful Fox News interviewer. How could a Muslim write about Jesus? And that got a lot of publicity. And so maybe it's a little bit out of whack, but the credit for the book has gotten more press than it really was due. But Jared, would you start us with a quick assessment of Aslan's book? And then I'll just let the two of you segue into the four or five just quickly who is Jesus kind of things. And then Lindsay and I can kind of ask some questions at the end as of the outsiders.
Okay, so I need to confess that I have not read Aslan's book, you know, for the following reasons. I've listened to several interviews by him, and I've read book reviews. So Aslan's theory is not new. You know, this idea, Richard Horsley is someone that Eric mentioned earlier, this idea of that Jesus was a, you know, advocated the violent overthrow of the Roman Empire, because there were zealots. I mean, zealots, and he was crucified as an insurrectionist. So pretty much the fundamental question, and this is actually a debate in the New Testament class that I've taught, is, did Jesus advocate the violent overthrow of the Roman Empire? And we need to be very, very clear on the following difference. Jesus taught that the world was going to change and the Romans would no longer have power over the covenantal land that God promised the Jews. Now, here is the absolute fundamental distinction that I think Aslan is on the wrong side of. The question is, did Jesus teach that God was going to do the violent overthrowing, or did Jesus advocate that he and his followers should do the violent overthrowing? So it's the difference between teaching the second coming and planting a bomb in a mall.
Mm-hmm.
Huge, huge difference. You know, it's the difference between a Christian preacher and the Unabomber. Like, I cannot overemphasize this. You are either a preacher or a terrorist with these two differences. I think one of the fundamental problems with Aslan's argument, as I understand it, is, so what scholars have to do is you have to determine which traditions are authentic and which are later rethinkings. And this is where you definitely get the whole, like, in your own image problem. And what Aslan suggested is that Jesus was originally a violent revolutionary, and later Christians who wanted to placate Rome invented this peaceful, nice, chill Jesus. And I think that Jesus as an apocalyptic prophet makes the most sense, because what you have is you have a controversial figure, because you can't have Jesus too lovey-dovey, or why would he have gotten killed?
Right.
You know, it's not like the Romans were like, whoa, you are too much of a hippie. You know, stop talking about love and tolerance too much. You know, you have to die. If Jesus taught that God was going to overthrow the Roman Empire and he was going to destroy the temple because the temple was defiled, and that is one of the most likely sayings, actually, is it's multiply attested that Jesus taught God will destroy this temple, you know, the Jewish temple. And I think that he taught that God was going to overthrow the Roman Empire. But that is very different than what Aslan suggests, is that Jesus said, we need to overthrow the Roman Empire.
Right.
So if anything, the deeds that seem to be historically verifiable is that he was struggling with the priestly aristocracy in Jerusalem, who, yes were collaborators with the Roman government, but... I actually would differ with you. Short of that God's going to overthrow all governments, I don't think you can demonstrate that Jesus said he was going to overthrow necessarily the Roman Empire specifically.
No, you are correct. That is a more accurate way of saying it. Jesus taught that God was going to renew creation. God was going to, and part of that was the restoration of the covenantal land, but that God was going to renew all of creation and restore the earth to a paradisiacal state, you know, and that's the messianic era. That's, you know, Ha'olam Haba, the world to come, in it, rather than this world, you know, this present age, which was the powers of evil.
So that's proximate cause, whether it be his cleansing of the temple threatening the priestly monopoly there, or the popularity because of the Lazarus episode, whether you look at Synoptics or John, it was a threat to the priestly collaborators that seemed to have set things in motion.
Right.
And I don't think we have any evidence of him advocating guerrilla or violent action otherwise, except for cleansing the temple.
Okay. Yeah. Joel Marcus makes a really compelling case, I think, where our earliest source, Mark, our earliest gospel, where in the apocalyptic discourse, where there was an earlier source, I'm talking about Mark 13, Jesus says, you know, let the reader understand, or Mark says, you know, let the reader understand when the temple has been defiled. And that is Mark being extremely negative about what could be the zealots defying the temple, you know. So, like, Mark is anti-zealot. Now, we do need to acknowledge that Jesus was crucified as a zealot. He was crucified as an insurrectionist.
Yeah. Be careful with the terminology zealot. That's anachronistic.
Yes.
As a nationalist. Good. Zealots don't happen until after Claudius.
Oh, right. Okay. Excellent. So he was crucified as an insurrectionist. And why we know this is, I think the very first words ever written about Jesus was the sign on the cross. And what the sign on the cross was, is it was the crime for which he was executed. So it said, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. And there's that little saying in the Gospels where it's, oh, don't say he was King of the Jews, that he claimed to be the King of the Jews. So that's very historically solid. But that does not mean that Jesus advocated the violent overthrow of the Roman Empire. That is just that he was understood to be some sort of ruler figure, and it could have been a misunderstanding. You know, interestingly, I don't think that there's a way that this could have been historically transmitted, but I certainly understand that Pilate could have been trying to get at this in John, for example, where Pilate was like, well, is your kingdom of this world or not? You know, are you a political revolutionary or not? And I think it's plausible, and it fits best with the parables and the teachings and everything Jesus was doing, where he's like, well, no, you know, like, the kingdom I am teaching is the kingdom that God is going to shortly establish. And yes, I have a starring role in that kingdom. Another solid saying is where Jesus says to the apostles, or his disciples, you know, you will rule the 12 tribes on 12 thrones. And why that's so likely is because it includes Judas.
Right.
But if Jesus can allocate thrones, what does that make him? You know, that makes him, he's on a throne of thrones. So I definitely think that he taught he was the Messiah. And I think that's what Judas betrayed, you know, Judas. Okay. So what we have a balance here where Jesus foretelling that God was going to overthrow all the powers would have gotten him killed. But that doesn't mean that he said, we need to do it yourself. And that is the fundamental line that the insurrectionists and the political revolutionaries and the terrorists that differentiated it from the prophetic tradition that I think Jesus.
Dan, all right, so Aslan is basically on that side of the line. What would be some counter sources? So in other words, if somebody picked up Aslan, what else should they pick up in order to kind of really weigh it?
What I was going to suggest then as a corrective is, you know, a lot of people come to new subjects through popularizing books like Aslan.
Right.
But you don't just stop there. You
nice.
Find a source written by someone in that field. So, you know, E.P. Sanders has written on the historical Jesus. One I like, which is kind of a moderate position, is John P. Meyer's 3-volume. It's going to be 4-volume soon, Marginal Jew. You know, get into some things that are going to go through all these arguments. But I think specifically for that portion of your audience who are primarily going to always approach this from a position of faith, but simply want the historical Jesus to accent or help them appreciate that faith better. I would look at Luke Timothy Johnson's writings. One I was just talking to Jared about that I've recently worked through is Craig Evans's Fabricating Jesus. These are, I guess, what we'd call kind of right of center scholars. They're believing scholars. They go through all these criteria, show how they work, but they also point out the problems in it. I think what, Lindsay, we don't want to do is just get sucked into this and say, oh, I can't believe anything anymore, is we want to look at how believing people use these same critical tools to come up with different answers or approaches.
Can I clarify on those sources for just
sure,
a minute?
Please.
So I think Aslan, he markets himself very well. And from what I've heard, Zealot is very readable. It's very entertaining. So he should get credit for continuing the conversation, but it shouldn't stop the conversation. We'll link to these sources, and I want to be clear that so Aslan is an interesting, you know, Zealot is an interesting popular book that I don't think is historically accurate. I don't think it gives the right picture. And the books that Eric just mentioned fall into two primary categories. And what you'll just be guided by what you're looking for. E.P. Sanders has a book, Jesus and Judaism is probably too detailed, but he has the historical figure of Jesus. Bart Ehrman has a very entertaining book, Jesus, Apocalyptic Prophet of the New Millennium. John Meyer is, if you want multiple volumes, you know, a marginal Jew. Gerd Thiessen has a couple books. But the other books that he mentioned, Luke Timothy Johnson wrote The Real Jesus, and then Craig Evans wrote Fabricating Jesus. And that is more a faithful scholar critiquing of the methodologies of the historical Jesus. Does Craig Evans also give kind of an introduction to the historical Jesus?
Yeah, he does. He gives a basic introduction, and then what he does is he goes through the different criteria of authenticity and shows how they work well, and then gives cautions about how they can be misused. He's really good, for instance, about questionable text and the problems of dating. You know, we didn't even get into the apocryphal stuff because it's so late.
Yeah.
He has a whole chapter called Cramped Starting Points, and he talks about the assumptions scholars bring to the table before they even begin the research. So I think particularly for, you know, people who are always going to have a believing position, it's a comfortable way to begin the investigation.
Yeah, so those books allow room for faith. And then if you just want like one book that gives you an overview of, you know, what do scholars think about the historical Jesus, I like Sanders and Ehrman are both really, really accessible. Is there any other one that you would recommend, Eric, as far as...
No, I mean, these books are getting bigger and larger the more we name, so I think we want to keep accessible.
Thanks, you guys. Lindsay, I know that we've got to end here pretty quick. What's on your brain today that you still haven't brought up, and we'll hopefully have time to keep Eric around to answer?
Well, it's a question completely out of left field.
Yay.
Sure. So when talking about the historicity of Jesus, I'm really curious about your opinions on... his DNA, his conception, and how he came into this world, how it framed Mary, how it framed her in the day, if the story happened as it is told in the Bible.
Eric, we'll turn to you because I know you have to leave in about 5 minutes.
Well, and you know that I'm going to.
You can't do down. A 5 minute answer for this one. Yeah,
I'll add you a little more time. There's no doubt. In fact, we can use the criterion of embarrassment here. There's no doubt that the circumstances surrounding the conception of Jesus were not usual. There's no doubt. I mean, because Matthew would not have put this in the genealogy of Jesus. He wouldn't have highlighted the kind of irregularities with the female figures in the genealogy of Jesus. You know, if this did not happen.
Calling him the son of Mary is also unusual.
Yeah.
So those point to
no
something is up.
There was question about legitimacy. So how do you deal with that? Well, either he was illegitimate or he really wasn't the son of Joseph and he must have been conceived some other way. Early Christians, you know, immediately went with what the Spirit taught them on this. And I'm going to approach this purely from a position of faith because I don't think historically there's anything you can say about it. All you can say historically is that there was question, that his conception was not usual. At least it did not seem
irregular. Yeah.
It was irregular. That's better. Thank you, Jared. Was it a divine conception, a miraculous birth? From a position of faith, I would say absolutely. Can I demonstrate that historically? No. But that is exactly what Jarrett said at the outset of this episode, is that faith issues should be kept distinct. I actually think we sometimes weaken faith when we try to establish faith by academic, intellectual, or historical methods. The only way that anyone will ever know that Jesus Christ is the Son of God is by revelation from the Spirit.
Lindsay, if I can give you a brief historical answer, I agree with you that there's not much we can say. The most solid thing is, once again, his conception was in question and irregular. So if we can only use the methods of scholarship, it's correct that whether he was, in what way is he the Son of God? That's the question, a question of faith. So I think that either Jesus, this is just historically, what historians would conclude. Either Jesus was conceived by Joseph before their marriage, and I think this has fascinating social implications, Lindsay, as far as like shaming illegitimacy and stuff. I think this may be uncomfortable, but I think that historically we can conclude Jesus was illegitimate. And even if he was born of God, he was illegitimate. So I think that's, we can conclude that, because either he was conceived by Joseph outside of marriage, perhaps after the betrothal, or he was conceived by someone else.
Or the conception was not just divine, which can mean a lot of things in Mormonism, but also miraculous.
Yeah. But that would be the someone else. So that's all history can give on that.
Yeah.
Interesting. Follow up, Lindsay?
Nope. That was my question.
All right. Well, Eric, you've got to run. So, final thoughts, just anything that you want to share, and then after you drop off, we can do the same thing with the rest of us.
All right. Well, I just want to say that I hope that those who've listened to this might get interested in historical Jesus studies. They may read around in it, but I would simply remind them that you can do this as a historical endeavor, or you can do it as something that will accent or deepen your faith. But if your interest in Jesus is in a divine figure, a salvific figure, I think you are going to be a little dissatisfied if you approach it only from a position of academic inquiry. Once again, these criteria simply demonstrate that something can be verifiable by historical methods. Does not disprove other things that we believe about Jesus. Simply can bring to bear some external evidence supporting some of the things we believe about him. So I obviously find this interesting and can talk about it for hours. You need to know that that is only ancillary, because my real interest in Jesus is Jesus, the risen Lord.
Awesome. And for me, I always want to throw the layer and what that has done to my own heart, what that has done to my own sense of myself, that I'm loved being, a worthy being, etc. So it's not just that I get the, oh, here's the theory of what's the problem and here's the solution and he did this. It's how that's transformed me. Is that a fair extension for you?
Well, absolutely. I mean, knowing that Jesus is the Son of God, that he suffered and died for us and rose again, doesn't do anything if it doesn't transform us.
Right.
And so if our faith is transformative and blesses our life and the lives of others, regardless of what you believe about salvation, exaltation, etc., it's a worthy thing. I just think it's always an important caution for those of us who believe that we're spiritual beings, that we don't rely simply on one half of our existence, that we don't just rely upon intellectual endeavors, rational endeavors, but that we recognize there's another side of us that's just and perhaps more vital.
Preaching to the choir here. Thank you.
Sorry, I preach it for a living. That's what I do as a practitioner, priest. Held off as long as I could.
Thanks for your time, Eric.
Thank you, brother.
Dee and Dan.
Can I say my follow-up to that?
Go for it.
Yeah, I would also like to say that I actually think that history and the academic part is actually very helpful to me. I would say faith building to me, because what it does is it helps me move away from the literalness of the narratives that I was taught growing up that were someone else's interpretation, and gives me flexibility to adopt my own interpretation. So if we have history breaking down the paradigms of what we think God is, history continues to do that. I think that that keeps us flexible as a people. I think it keeps us our hearts soften and our minds open to God's will. And that is why I appreciate history and academic research, because I think it always challenges us. It always breaks down our paradigms. And I think that that's what faith is about.
Awesome, Lindsay. Thanks. And you know, that works for me too. And I'll just have to confess here, I may be a little bit the outsider, maybe not so much with Jared. He can have to do this, but what this stuff has done for me is also opened me up to Eastern spirituality, you know, because of the difficulties and the stuff here. It's led me to even think outside the paradigm of whether sin is a problem that needs a divine being, you know, all those different things there. And so that's led me to look at the different proposals for what is the fundamental problem that we're trying to overcome here through, you know, life and stuff like that. And what it's led to me is sort of the uniting of Eastern and Christian Western stuff on we've forgotten who we are, we've forgotten the divinity, we've gotten distracted by the day-to-day stuff, we've gotten distracted by our bodies, we've gotten distracted by all of our putting our confidence and our trust in the daily things around us. And so it's opened me up. And so like when I was following up with Eric there about how has it had transformed your heart, that seems to me to be the core of both things like this. And so I'm gladly a Christian, I'm gladly preach it, I'll testify of Christ and things like that. But part of me, through this academic exercise of 20 years of pulling apart these things and, you know, studying a lot of the stuff that was talked about today myself, it did what you say, Lindsay, is it's forced me out of the normal literalistic things. For me, it also forced me to go east and then come back west and come back into my Christian faith with this whole sense of I've just got to center myself in my own connection with the divine and this the idea that I am a divine being myself. And somehow this connection and the energy that I feel sort of churning at the base of my life and sort of backlighting and showing connections throughout everything has been what it's done there. So you led me there. I don't know if I made any sense.
No, you did. That was great.
Jared, it seems like you and I, when we did that salvation extra one, you may have a little bit similar to me in terms of it's helped you think outside the whole Christian story too, but you gladly walk and talk within the Christian story?
Yeah, what I'd like to sum up, I mean, my own personal journey, of course, is similar to the approach that I think is it advocates. I think the value of academia and the value of the scholarship is, I think it really empowers your personal journey. And I feel like, you know, this is a two to three witnesses type thing where we're all saying similar things, where we can graduate beyond the Jesus of primary and we can look to our own relationships with Jesus and with God. Because the way that I look at it is, first, I want to emphasize that the very most real and most important thing is your own, each of our individual relationships with Jesus, with God. And the value of academia, scholarship, other views, is it can challenge what we've been taught and kind of those scripts and the easy images of God. You know, God has no grandchildren is a quote that I love. And it calls us to figure out what is God to us? What is revelation to us? What is Jesus to us? So for example, for me, I am incredibly inspired by the story of Jesus of Nazareth, you know, and and also the struggles that early Christians had to understand tragedy. I'm not going to go in detail about my thoughts on Jesus from a perspective of faith. We've talked about that elsewhere. Again, what I think the value of the historical Jesus is that we can allow ourselves to be challenged. And as we look at the Gospels with new eyes, as we have a greater appreciation for, oh, you know, there was disagreement, there was this reinterpretation, it was this living tradition of trying to understand the significance of Jesus. And it calls you to go on the same quest. It calls each of us to have our own quest for Jesus, you know, both to understand and God to understand, well, okay, so this is what scholars can say. This is what historians can say. And I'm hoping what listeners will get from this episode is that the Gospels especially can gain greater power, and that we can bracket a little bit the Jesus that we learned in primary and say, oh, well, what can I learn about Jesus from Mark? What can I learn about Jesus from Luke and from Matthew and from John? And once again, I think the beginning and the end of the story has to be, well, what is my relationship? Yeah. And what does it do for me? And what does it do to me? And I can, you're correct that back to that Paul verse, you know, I am become all things to all people. I think it's very, very important to be able to speak multiple languages. And so in the Sunday School podcast, for example, less in Mormon Matters, I do value speaking the language of faith. And I, but one thing that I sincerely do is I can bear my testimony of this. I think there is room to believe in Jesus. You know, there is room to believe in the Christ. There is room to believe in Jesus as Lord. And there are multiple ways that we can believe in Jesus as Savior. And I feel called, and I would invite everyone to go on that own, that personal quest. And once again, to reiterate, I think that these historical details and complexities can empower us and challenge us in that quest for meaning and transformation.
Awesome. Lindsay, anything out going out the door here at the end of this triple podcast of ours?
Nope. I mean, I have a million questions, but I think we're out of time. So we'll have to do follow-ups or something.
Great. Please come to everybody, to the respective blogs of whoever you're listening to this through, or come to all three and make your comments, and we'll certainly have a great discussion. While you're there, all these podcasts require or rely upon your donations. So please feel free to donate to Mormon Matters, Engaging Gospel Doctrine, as well as Feminist Mormon Housewives podcast. It's greatly appreciated. Would you guys agree?
Yes, necessary.
Yep.
Thank you so much. Hey, thanks. This was fun. Let's do another one of these triples one of these times soon. I'll let one of you guys host.
Sounds good. Thanks, Ben.
Sounds good. Good night, everybody. Appreciate your good support, and we'll see you soon. Take care.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.